previously on the last CD. Albrecht had just been suspended, and here we begin with Sarah on CD2. Sarah is going to Eric and Shelley's old residence just to visit, just kind of pay homage to her missing friends who are irreplaceable to her. Okay, we're starting the second CD now. One, two, three, play, and here we go. There's some more of that cryptic tarot card stuff that whoever did it refused to talk about. These are all standing buildings on these sets. They've been used for hundreds of films. They just redress them slightly. This is a scene in the book where Eric realizes he's coming to the end of his mission here on this earthly plane, so he destroys everything physical. He wants to leave nothing behind. That particular sequence there, where Eric is swinging Shelley in the field, was actually shot in Seattle, not too far from Bruce's grave. And originally it was intended to be one of the final shots in the film, where Eric and Shelley are supposed to be in heaven. That was going to be Proyas's version of heaven. He decided to stay away from that. You know, the irony being that less than 8 months later, Brandon was going to be buried, you know, basically in the same spot. Sarah feels abandoned by Eric, and somehow miraculously Gabrielle has survived the ensuing year, and obviously she realizes someone has been there, and the only one it could possibly be is Eric, and now she feels a little betrayed. This is partially where a lot of the supernatural elements start to creep into the film that I thought were unnecessary, and I thought detracted a lot from the emotional impact of the film. But we'll get to those in a minute. I really love all the circular design elements that Alex Proyas and Alex McDowell, the production designer, worked into the film. You know, when I actually met Angel David out of costume and in person at an art gallery showing I had of original Crow paintings, I didn't even recognize him. He was this clean-cut little short guy. You know, I had my pictures taken that night with all the bad guys, and would you know it, I would be the big threatening one. You know, they were all 5'4", 5'5", and I was the 6'2" guy in the leather jacket. So it was, you know, just little ironic, comical side thing aside there that just Hollywood magic tends to make people look 100 feet tall. I actually accused them of drugging the cat here because I could never get him to sit still that long. And of course they insisted there were no drugs of any sort on the set. Chuckle, chuckle. In case you didn't hear the satire in my voice there. Satire, irony. Mikos was a cat I had for about 10 years, and he was the one who invested me with my love of cats. And here's Graham Rouvrell's guitar solo. And I really like the way it builds up into a frenzy to where it's almost out of his control anymore, and it just explodes into just pure fury to where he begins smashing the amp and the guitar, despite the fact you still hear chords coming out of it. This was the scene that Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails were supposed to do, but he was contractually obligated to finish an album on time, and could not spend the 10 days to 2 weeks on the set that it would take to film this, much to my disappointment and his, because he was a big fan of The Crow. I think Thrill Kill Cult did a nice job overall, and the music makes a nice backdrop to what was called the big Moby shootout in the script. There are a lot of extras in here, a lot of people that were not necessarily actors, but just people that were helpful on the set. And in fact, David Scowl, who did one of the drafts of the screenplay, is actually one of the bad guys in here as well. The wrapping around Skank's shoulders from where one of the 10-year-olds shot him as he was running out of the convenience store. I was impressed with Michael Wincott here because he basically improvised a lot of his dialogue here, and it not only did it make sense, it I think it added a lot to his character. It went beyond having a simple motive of greed for the character, which would have been just typical and just very Hollywood formulaic. This entire sequence was shot inside an abandoned cement factory. And there is virtually the ceiling is like 60 feet in the air, and there's only two walls. The cameras were on the open-sided end of the kiosk, and they never really showed any upward shots to where you would notice that there wasn't a ceiling. And to use a French term, it was colder than a motherfucker in that place. It was every they had to bring in heaters to keep everybody's breath from showing up on screen. And this was one of my favorite memorabilia days, because I after the big shootout, I went through with some great big Tupperware containers and picked up empty shells and by the hundreds and bloody fake money, and I got handfuls of earplugs that they hand out before each scene where there's going to be a lot of gunfire. So I picked up all kinds of little trinkets this day to give to friends and whatnot. This scene basically ran, I believe, close to 11 minutes long. Brandon Lee and Jeff Imada, the stunt coordinator and a very good friend of his, planned this thing out for 3 weeks, and there were 14 actors in this scene, and they worked out through gunfire and swords and various martial arts techniques and whatnot. They worked out killing every single one of these bad guys, and all of it was filmed. Brandon did some amazing things with the samurai sword he pulls out of the showcase. There were shots of arms flying through the air with the gun still shooting bullets out of them. He just It was just like a wild frenzy of carnage where he just pulled all the stops out. He used every John Woo trick that he had ever learned, and they just pushed things to the absolute limit, because this was supposed to be kind of like the climax to the film, or the climax to the violence at any rate. And I know he worked really hard on this, and he was really proud of it. And because of what happened to Brandon, because he was killed during the filming of this, the MPA was really oversensitive to the amount of violence in the film, and they give it an X rating 3 times. And since they refused to tell you what they object to, the producers were left in a predicament of just cutting randomly. And yes, this was a particularly brutal sequence, but I think it was justifiably so. I mean, I don't think anyone argued that, there was any just okay, swell guys in here who didn't get what was coming to them. I think everything in here was justified. And it saddens me that since this is the last thing Brandon will ever do, that you guys will ever see from him, that all this beautiful almost ballet type action is setting in a warehouse somewhere, setting in a vault, the colors draining away from it. For no reason at all. I mean, this is 10 years later. This film would have, other than for coarse language, this film would have barely got an R rating, I believe. It could have probably pushed a hard PG-13. This was Brandon's idea to do this little Looney Tunes dance out the side. And he's basically like shot to pieces at this point with all the shotguns and 9 millimeters and all the gunfire he took. So it's taking him a little longer to return to his normal state. Once again, Brandon making those incredible jumps, just never hesitating. Jeff Imada, who did this fall, actually came very close to hurting himself by catching his boot on one of the 2x4s that the sign was built on, and almost missed his mark of the silver painted cardboard and landed on the cement. But he was lucky and hit the mark just enough to not injure himself. Another beautiful shot of a city made out of old Cheerios boxes. Cheerios boxes and Christmas tree lights. You know, this is where the supernatural elements come into the film, and I thought, you know, I didn't think there was really any need for them. They were gratuitous, and I didn't think, they said, well, the crow needs to have an Achilles heel. There has to be some way to hurt him. And the way to hurt him is that he helps an innocent. You know, he goes out of his way. He goes off his revenge path to help an innocent. And then he's able to be hurt by natural forces. And I disagreed with that. I didn't think, there needed to be this Achilles heel. I mean, everyone rooted for the Terminator, and they knew he was indestructible. It was just a Hollywood element that, they thought, well, it's in the formula. There has to be some way to hurt him. I thought all the supernatural stuff kind of detracted from it. You have to give the audience credit. They're not 5-year-olds. You don't need to stop every 10 minutes and explain to them what's going on, which is essentially what the Skull Cowboy character was. Originally, there was this character called the Skull Cowboy who was essentially Death, who appears every 15 minutes, and he's talking to Eric, explaining to him what's going on with his life. But in essence, what he was really doing was talking to the audience, explaining to them what was happening. And I argued with him, come on, you guys, the material isn't that dense. These people are intelligent. They'll understand what's going on. And luckily, even though I love Michael Behrman, he's a dear friend, luckily he looked like a big guy in a rubber suit, so none of that stuff was ever shot, and it was jettisoned before it could become a big problem. Because they get to this point where, well, we've spent this much money on it, it has to be in the film, whether it's crap or not. So luckily, it looked like shit from the beginning, and I don't know. Could someone please explain the Hollywood mentality of hiring someone with a face like Michael Behrman, who, for you who don't know, is the guy from The Hills Have Eyes, and then covering him completely in latex so you can't even tell who the fuck he is? It could have been the janitor for all anyone else knew. That's Hollywood mentality. But luckily that character was jettisoned, and no apologies have to be made for it. In the book, Death continually taunts him, but it isn't like a character that he physically interacts with. In the book, I never gave the characters last names. I wanted to keep it very generic and very everyman. John Shirley tells me he came up with Draven from Driven and Raven. And Webster, because a dictionary happened to be sitting on the corner of his table. So there's Hollywood brilliance for you. This is a really beautiful shot, that the overhead shot from the ceiling of the church. Beautiful, flawless matte shot that just shows you how much care Alex Perez takes in setting up all of his filming shots.